Okay, let's get started on lecture 10. Talked about discrete wavelet filters a little in the previous lecture. So I'm going to go through this just fairly quickly to start with. The point being that until now when we're talking about wavelet transforms, we're talking about transforms of a continuous function. But we don't deal with continuous functions in signal processing, we deal with sampled functions. And so we need some sort of transform of these sampled functions, and I'm just calling that the discrete wavelet filters for the moment, as an analog of the discrete Fourier transform. It works directly by the way you would expect it to work. Instead of having an integral over continuous wavelet functions, we have an integral over, or we have a sum, which turns out to be a convolution with a filter, and that filter is what we call our wavelet filter. We have different wavelet filters at each scale to start out with, but if we want to, well, I'm going to skip over this page just for a moment. So we write this as a convolution. We have different wavelet filters at each scale. We can derive what those wavelet filters look like by some simple sampling of the continuous wavelet functions. So for instance, with the Haar wavelets, we end up with, well, the Haar wavelets, we have a scaling function that looks like a rectangular pulse and a mother wavelet that, as a result of the various conditions that we force on these multi-resolution analyses, the mother wavelet looks like we didn't come up with a good word to describe this. It looks like two rectangular pulses, one of which has been reversed. When we sample this for the scaling function, we just sample at two points here and we get 1, 1. We sample the mother wavelet, we get 1, minus 1, but we also have a square root 2 factor in there because of the dilation that happens to go to scale 1. And as we change scales, we get a new series of filters at each scale. Okay, so this would be one way of doing the wavelet transform. You just work out what the filter looks like at each scale and you apply that filter at each scale. For instance, you see at j equals 4, we have a moving average for the scaling function. It's just a moving average over, 16 points? Moving average over 16 points is going to smooth a lot more than a moving average over 8 points. So you can see that the Haar filters, as you go up scales, they smooth more and more. This is why we call it a multi-scale or multi-resolution analysis, multi-resolution approximation. This scaling function gives us approximations to that function which are given by averages over longer and longer time intervals. And this sort of makes sense. You have higher scales, the filters get longer and longer, they do more and more averaging. The filter, the wavelet filter, looks like a sort of multi-step differencer. Differences this chunk of average from this chunk of average. So you average over a period and then take some differences. We also see the frequency responses of these filters over here. It's a bit hard to see my little pointer at the moment. Battery is running down. Okay. The issue with doing wavelet filters like this, the issue that we have is that wavelet filters are... These filters, they're getting longer and longer. And there's a different filter for each scale. So with the Haar wavelets, it's pretty obvious what those filters are going to look like. They're not too complicated, pretty easy to calculate. With a more complicated wavelet, we might have to spend a great deal more time doing that calculation. So we want to have a more efficient way of computing the wavelet transform, and at the same time, it would be nice if it was a bit easier for us to remember how to do it. So the way we do that is by realizing that when we take our detail and our approximation, the separation into these two spaces can be done with a high pass and a low pass filter. And then we realize that this approximation space is just another approximation space. And as we saw in the continuous case, we can take an approximation space and we can also break it into details and approximations. So we do that, we build a series of filter banks, Naively, if we do that, we end up with filters that look like G1, G2, G3. They change at each scale still. But the really neat trick is that when we downsample after doing each one of these guys, we end up with using the same filters at each scale. And this is a really neat trick, because now we only have to learn one filter. This filter has a fixed short number of taps, hopefully. In the case of, say, the Haar wavelet, this is a two-tap filter, so it's really short. This downsampling means that at each step we reduce the amount of data we have to deal with. So here, we say we have n data points here, we have n on two data points here. So the total amount of data coming out of these two filter banks is still n. And then when we pass it through here, we have n on 2 plus n on 4 plus n on 4 adds up to n. And likewise, all the way down here, we never have to store more than n data points to calculate this thing. And likewise, the number of computations we do, because you decrease by a factor of 2 as you go down here, you get this logarithmic reduction in computation the further you go down through this tree, and that means that the total number of computations you have to do is order n as well. In fact, it's n times the length of these filters, times 2, because you have two sets of filters. So this is a very efficient way of doing it. One of the other things I showed you earlier on in the course is how you can do this downsampling slightly more cleverly. What you do is you do the downsampling before you run through the filter, and that reduces the amount of computation you have to do by a factor of 2 as well. So you can make this whole thing very, very efficient, much more efficient than the Fourier transform for long data sequences. And it can be done online. You can be doing this as data comes into this tree. It can just trickle down through this pyramidal decomposition, and you get the different detail and approximation values as you go through it. So this is a very elegant, very nice algorithm. This is about where I think we left off at the end of the last lecture. So this is a block diagram, and personally I find block diagrams extremely useful for understanding the structure of an algorithm and what happens in that algorithm, but I don't find them very useful in terms of how I actually go away and I do the calculations if I had to do it by hand, for instance, or if I had to implement this. If I had to implement this thing as code. Sorry. We've already talked about reconstruction, we talked about the dyadic grid and so on. Here, we're talking about what the decomposition algorithm looks like in terms of math, how you would actually go about doing these calculations. So, firstly, notice that when I'm going from scale j, the approximation, to scale j plus 1, all I'm doing is a convolution with a filter, and then I'm downsampling. So the nth point here, after the downsampling, is the 2nth point of the convolution. That's just saying that I only take every second point out of this thing. If I put 2n into my convolution, I get a convolution that looks like this. I just have a 2n in here instead of an n. So this is my convolution with a filter. We've already worked out how you derive that sort of filter. We've looked at one way of deriving that sort of filter. Likewise, when we're getting the detail, we also do a convolution with the approximation at the previous scale. Remember, we're always taking decompositions of approximations. The detail, once you have the detail, you don't do anything more to that. It's the approximations that we keep decomposing. And again, we decompose it by doing a convolution with a filter and then a downsampling operation by taking every 2nth data point. So this is how you actually go about doing that computation. The reconstruction looks exactly the same. This is one of the nice things. Remember, this is the reconstruction, the picture of the reconstruction. It's just an upsampling and then passing through the same filters. So here we have are equations for the upsampling and passing through the filter. And the reason you can see it's an upsampling is we've got an nth point here, but we're taking a 2nth point in our filter. Another way to think about this is we've inserted zeros into our sequence. So actually, we could write a new sequence A hat plus 1 at data point 2m, and the ones at 2m take these values, and the ones at 2m plus 1, the odd terms, take the value 0, but we omit the 0 terms from this sum because they're just 0. So this is just an upsampled version of this sequence convolved by this filter again. You notice in this case though we've convolved with a time reverse version of the filter. Here we're convolving with the filter itself, not the time reverse version of the filter. So we're taking this filter, we're also taking the details and putting them through their filter, the G's, and we end up back with our approximation at the next finer scale or octave J. So I have an example here, and you have another example I think in your class exercise to get you around the thought process of this. And I'm going to go through this example fairly quickly, but particularly when you're doing your class exercise, you'll probably want to go away and you'll want to think about this example some more. In fact, I think this example is almost exactly the same as the one in the class exercise. So I'm not really going to go through this in any level of detail at all. Part of the point of the class exercise is for you to work through this example so that you get to understand what's going on here. And all of the details are written out for you. You can see what's going on at each step. You can see how you form the approximations by taking this convolution with the filters of each of these terms. So I'm not going to go through that, but I will give you a picture of what's going on. Now remember, with the Ha wavelets, the scaling filter just looks like 1-1 with a scale factor, but I'm going to ignore the scale factor to make my life easy for presenting your results. So if I put this sequence of data points through a filter which goes 1-1, it's going to be adding these two together. That will give me 0, 0, 0, but I'm going to downsample those 4 points that I would get, and so I end up with 2 values of 0. Here I add these two together and I get 2. Add these two together, I get 2. Add these two together, I get 2. But then I downsample and I get 1. I get 1 value of 2, 1 value of 2. And I ignore the point that I would have got here, which would have been these two added together, which would have given me a 1. There would have been a 1 here, but because I downsample, I drop that point out. I ignore it. Likewise, there would have been a 1 here, and that point is being dropped out. Those points are being sampled away. So this is what happens when I go from my original sequence X to the A1, the first octave approximation. Likewise, as you go further and further down, you just do the same thing again and again. So you do the same thing to get to the second scale, and you end up with a picture like this, where these are my approximations at successive scales. You can see that here I had 4 data points, here I have 2, here I have 1. And at each time, it's a sort of average over those guys, or a sum over those guys. You can see, once I get to this point, I'm averaging over summing over all of these 8 points. And 4 of them have got a value of 1, so I get a value of 4. Here, this point is averaging, or summing over these 8 points, so I get a value of 2. So you can see what's happening there visually, and hopefully this makes a lot of sense. The reason that we can't always have such a nice visual view of the transform is because most of the filters that you use in these transforms are not quite as simple as the Ha transform. And this is an interesting point. One of the things that's going on here is modulo the scaling factor. So there's a scaling factor that's a bit different here, but with ignoring the scaling factor, you can think of this set of data points is approximating these set of data points. So A1 is genuinely, it looks like an approximation to the data. But in general, these A1, A2, A3 coefficients, they need not look anything like this data. Depends what the filter looks like. The actual approximation of the data, the thing that would be a really useful approximation, is this thing. It's the filter convolved with these data points. When you add these details here, you get back to this approximation, but if you just take these guys, you get an approximation at octave J plus 1. That's the projection of this data into this approximation space. So we talk about these coefficients, we call them the approximation, but they're not actually an approximation by themselves. They're really what we should say, if we were going to be strictly accurate, is we should call them the approximation coefficients. The approximation itself is a filtered version of those. Okay, so this is what you would get for your multi-resolution analysis, and if you can't duplicate this for your class exercise, then you're in a bit of trouble. Now, one of the things you notice here is I stopped down here. I could have done another level of approximation here, but typically we don't do that. Typically we stop at trying to do approximations at some point. What point should that be? Well, it depends a little bit on the application. It depends on what you want to do. You keep the details down to this scale and you keep your approximation down to this point. And you can add up the number of points, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. Did I just add up 17? There should have been 16 points the same way we have in the original data sequence. If we just keep this approximation here and these details all the way up, we should be able to take this bottom level approximation and all of these details and go back up the tree and exactly reconstruct the original signal. Okay, why is that important? Well, we have finite signals here. When you have a finite signal, you notice that they're always going to be, well, it's not working very well. There are always going to be edge effects around the edge, where the filter goes off the edge of the data sequence. This corresponds to this same thing that we saw with leakage. You have truncation at the edge of your signal. And what we're implicitly assuming when we do a transform like this, where we do a convolution, is if we do a normal convolution, we're assuming there are zeros outside the length of that data. In reality, the signal probably wasn't zero outside of those data points, so we introduce edge effects with our filter. Another way of doing it would be you do a circular convolution, which implicitly assumes the data is periodic. So we probably don't do circular convolutions here. We'll stick to ordinary convolutions, but there's implicitly here a truncation of the signal at the edge, and that introduces edge effects. And the thing is, these edge effects seep further and further into the data as you go further and further down the scale. And how do you think about that? Well, remember that, just think about our wavelet filter at scale 1, scale 2, scale 3. Scale 1, it was a for the Haar wavelet, for instance, is a filter of length 2. At octave 2, it's a filter of length 4. At octave 3, it's a filter of length 8. The longer that filter is, the more of that edge gets brought into the data. So at these lower scales, these higher octaves, when J gets bigger, we get more and more of this truncation is being implicitly brought into the data because the filter we're using is longer and longer. The wavelet filter that we're using is longer and longer. So that's something you have to be aware of. And if you have a wavelet filter which has, say, 10 taps, then by the time you get down to here, it's going to be 10 by 2 to the 3, which is 80 taps, which means that you need a signal at least 80 data points long to make any sense at all in terms of performing this transform down to that level. You know, your data sequence in theory, if it's going to make any sense and you're not going to be seeing edge effects, should be longer than your filter that you're convolving it with. A factor of a few, preferably. Something else I was going to say about this before we went on. That's the other thing, you know. One of the things you can think about here is, let's go back to this one. What's this filter actually doing? Well, if you go through down to this level of approximation, you're doing this filter, then this filter, then this filter. That's putting those filters in series. So we can write out the filter transform, the transfer function, as just the product of the transfer functions of these three filters. So we know that, for instance, take this case where we're downsampling. If this filter has one pole, then when we go through here, we'll have a filter which has three poles. What does that mean? Well, think about what's going on here. This is a low-pass filter, so it's going to, say, have zeros in the high frequencies. So if it has a zero in the high frequency here, then we convolve it three times, we get three zeros in the high frequencies. So you might expect that the attenuation of the high frequencies is much more significant, and hence you get less high frequencies by the time you get down here. Also, when you downsample, it means that the band of frequencies that you're actually filtering off is going to be decreased. So each time you go through this downsampling, you're actually segmenting off a lower region of the frequency spectrum. And hence, this sort of sub-band coding view of the wavelet filters that I showed you last week. So there's a lot of different ways of thinking about these filters. This is just what I was saying before. We only need to keep the coefficients between certain scales. We keep the details between some scales and the approximation at the sort of highest octave that we consider. Another thing to think about is when we start doing our wavelet transform, should we start by using the xn's, these values of x that we have as our sampled data points? The answer is, assuming that certain regularity properties hold in our signal, our original signal, then that's fine. We take our original, our approximation at our finest scale or our smallest octave, these, say, A0 nominally, but I called it AL here, we would just take it to be the xn's with some scale factor. The scale factor, again, doesn't really matter because we typically don't care about the absolute magnitude, we care about relative values. So that's fine, but we have to have some sort of regularity property in the signal that we originally look at. Typically, this sort of regularity property comes down to something like it being a band-limited signal, the same way we did when we sampled in order to do a Fourier transform. We made sure that it was band-limited below the Nyquist frequency so that we don't get aliasing. We need the same sorts of properties here before we initialize our wavelet transform. If you don't have that, then you have to be a bit more clever about this initialization. But for all of the cases that we are going to think about here, this is sufficient. We just take our data to be sampled from a band-limited signal. Okay. Let's get back into slightly more complicated stuff for a minute. We have, in the past, looked at deriving the relationship between phi and psi. And we did that by considering the fact that we had this multi-resolution approximation space, and that our basis functions had to lie inside this space. So if the basis functions have to lie inside this space, then that imposes conditions on the relationship between these mother wavelets and mother scaling functions. The same thing is true when we consider the filter functions, the filters, H and the G, our high pass and low pass filter. There are conditions on them which are imposed by the structure of our multi-resolution analysis. So one of the properties we used before was the fact that the approximation at scale or octave J plus 1 should be a subspace of the approximation at octave J. In effect, that means the basis functions, the scaling functions for octave J plus 1 must be inside set VJ. What does it mean for them to be inside that set? Well, it means that we can write them as a linear combination of the basis functions for that set. So that's what I've done here. I've taken the basis functions for VJ plus 1 and I've written them as a linear combination of the basis functions of VJ. Now, you won't be surprised to learn that it makes sense for us to take these to be the approximation of the basis functions from VJ. And hence, these coefficients in our linear combination turn out to be the filter coefficients for our scaling filter. So what this is saying is that with these continuous functions, that are the basis for Vj and Vj plus 1, I can draw a relationship to the filter functions that I'm going to be interested in, the filters for the scaling filter. Clearly, once I have this sort of relationship, I can derive the coefficients, the Hn, by taking inner products between these two guys. That's just how I would have derived them in any case, doing the projection. So we take the case J equals 0, as we did when we were looking at the relationship between mother wavelets and mother scaling functions. When J is equal to 1, this thing is just one dilation of the mother wavelet, so we have one factor of 2 in here. This thing is just a translation of the mother wavelet, which is what we have here. H, the sum over n of Hn times by phi t minus n gives us a convolution of the two. So now we see that we can write our mother wavelet, mother scaling function, once it's been scaled, as a convolution of this filter function and the scaling function. So this relationship starts to define the values of this scaling function. Likewise, we can obtain these values by substituting this guy back into here, our inner product. And so we work out what the filter values are in terms of this inner product. So if we take a typical inner product, which is our L2 inner product, which looks like this, it's just an integral over the product of the two functions. Remember, for say the Haar wavelet, so this is the example of the Haar wavelet again. The Haar wavelet is going to be 0 outside the interval 0, 1. So this thing, this is a time scaling, this thing is going to be 0 outside the interval 0, 2, so I can get rid of it and replace it with the integral from 0 to 2. This thing is 0 outside of the interval from n to n plus 1. And so this integral is going to be 0 unless n is equal to 0 or 1, and in that case it just becomes 1 on root 2. So you get 1 on root 2, 0. Okay, so again, perhaps this is a little bit of magic for you. I'm going through it fairly quickly, I guess. What I'm trying to do is show you that these coefficients that we came up with for the Haar basis, they don't come out of thin air. There are logical reasons to choose the particular coefficients that we choose. And in fact, one of the activities that a lot of researchers in this area have spent a lot of time on is deriving particular wavelet bases that have particular properties. So they say, I want this particular property in my wavelet basis, and they go out and they derive what that wavelet basis should look like, and they use techniques like this. They work out what the mathematical conditions on those functions should be, and they go away and they derive how they should look. I've already mentioned the edge effect sort of thing to some extent. As I said, you can zero pad, that's what we typically do. We assume that the zero is outside the extent of the signal that we've observed. We could assume it was periodic and use circular convolutions. Another technique that people occasionally use is what they call boundary wavelets. The idea of boundary wavelets is you use a particular wavelet basis which has finite support and which vanishes outside that interval. Okay, so you can construct, as I said, you can take a particular property that you want to satisfy and you can construct wavelets which will do this. The problem here is you no longer end up with time invariant filters. So the way I presented wavelets to you, you always have these convolutions with time invariant filters. It's all very neat. Time invariant filters you can write as a convolution, it's easy to calculate. You use this pyramidal filter decomposition. But it's perfectly valid to construct a multi-resolution analysis where all of those filters are not the same. There's no time invariance. So you can't do a simple convolution anymore. The advantage of these guys is you don't get edge effects because you've explicitly said that your wavelets are going to have a particular length. The disadvantage is your wavelets have a particular length. If your signal changes in length or you have signals with different lengths, then you have to make up a new wavelet basis for every different case. Also, you no longer get that very, very efficient pyramidal decomposition algorithm because each of your filters is going to be different. You're going to have this no longer this time invariance property. So boundary wavelets are an interesting case, but I haven't actually used them myself. I find it very nice to have this simple structure to the transform you're doing. What are the properties of the Ha wavelet wavelet basis? Well, it's a very simple basis. It's easy to understand. It's intuitive. So that's a very nice property. The filters are short, two taps. It's very good in terms of computing performance. In fact, it turns out it's also the only linear phase symmetric wavelet with compact support. Compact support means we have a finite number of coefficients, or the filter is a finite impulse response filter. So these are all good properties. But remember, the filter looks like a rectangular pulse, so its behavior in the frequency domain is not particularly good. Having very sharp transitions in the time domain means we end up with very slow decay in the frequency domain. So it has nice properties in the time domain, but in the frequency domain it's not so great. And those edges also, they introduce artifacts when you do a lot of these transforms. So the Ha wavelet basis is typically the one that everyone learns when they're learning how to do wavelets. But if you want to use wavelets in practice, you have to move a little bit beyond the Ha wavelet basis. We can design better filters. As I said, there are a lot of target properties for our filters. Think about the sorts of regularity properties that we talked about when we were talking about windowing functions. All of those regularity properties become important here. Think about the transition region. Think about the filter in the frequency domain. How well does it do this subband coding? How well does it break the frequency domain into those bands? Think about how many taps the filter takes. Think about how long those filters are, how computationally complicated it is. What else? Think about the regularity of the functions. Think about whether or not we have to do a real or complex transform. As I said earlier, the Fourier transform is a complex transform. The basis functions are complex functions. But quite often in practice, when people are using a transform like that, they use something like the cosine transform. For instance, in JPEG, people use the cosine transform. Why do they do that? Well, the cosine transform is a real transform. It saves you doing a whole lot of multipliers if you can do real arithmetic rather than complex arithmetic. There are good reasons sometimes why you want to use a complex transform, though. And there's a whole, you know, research area on complex wavelets. Most of the wavelets I'm going to talk about, in fact, I think all of the wavelets I'm going to talk about to you are going to be real wavelets, where the wavelet basis functions are real. But you can have complex basis functions. Linear phase symmetric filters are nice in a lot of cases when you can use them, so people often seek filters that look symmetric. You can't always get filters that look symmetric and still have all the properties that you want them to have. So it's a condition that you can't always guarantee. This condition vanishing moments I'm going to talk about in a second, so I'll just go straight into that now. Okay, so this is one of the conditions people typically design into their wavelet filters, is for them to have a certain number of vanishing moments. A moment of the wavelet is an integral like this. So we take the integral from minus infinity to infinity of t to the k times our wavelet, our mother wavelet function. It's the integral of these things. This is the kth moment. So to say that we have p vanishing moments means that this moment for 0 to p minus 1, they all are 0. That's what it means to say we have p vanishing moments. Why would you care about vanishing moments? Well, the thing that vanishing moments give you is your wavelet's response to a polynomial. So imagine you have a polynomial that you want to transform. How would you transform that function? Any function. Well, what you do is you take an integral of that function with some wavelet basis functions. And the wavelet basis functions are all going to be translations or dilations of this mother wavelet. So we only have to really think about the mother wavelet for the moment. So we take a polynomial of order p minus 1 and we put it through this filter. Then the term which looks like t to the k is going to go to 0. And because it's a polynomial of order p minus 1, we only have terms where all of these things go to zero. So the wavelet transform of a polynomial of order p minus 1, where we have p vanishing moments, the wavelet transform will be zero. So what does this mean? Well, the wavelet essentially passes polynomials through it. There are two results of this. Firstly, one of the things we might want to do with a wavelet is analyze some statistical data. So statistical data, for instance, of, beer prices for the last 5 years. It's a good thing we could look at. Now, the two things that we might want to look at in that, we might want to look at the long-term trend, and it's easy enough to get the long-term trend. We just do a moving average. That's one of the things we've looked at in this course already. So we do a moving average, that will give us the long-term trend. But we also might want to look at the variations around that trend. Assume that the trend is linear. The trend is linear, then if we applied a wavelet with two vanishing moments, the trend would disappear. It wouldn't appear in the wavelet transform. It would just vanish because we have vanishing moments here. It would still appear in the approximation. It vanishes in the wavelet part. So it doesn't go away altogether. The approximation, we keep that bit. But in the wavelet part, it goes away. So analysis of the wavelet details would be sufficient for us to understand the variation around that trend. It's a way of separating the trend and the variations around it, which is really elegant because it just happens automatically as part of our transform. This is kind of cool. It gives you a way of analyzing data with trends without having to worry specifically about what the trend actually is. Secondly, a lot of the work that we would be interested in doing with wavelets is things like denoising data, taking the noise out of some data. So let's think about what that means. We have some underlying function which has had noise added to it. We want to get rid of that noise. So what if we make the assumption that our underlying function is locally pretty well approximated by a polynomial? We don't have to assume the whole thing is a polynomial. We can assume that a good chunk of it, can be well approximated by a polynomial of degree p. P minus 1, sorry. Then we apply wavelets with p vanishing moments, and all of that polynomial stuff, that will go into the approximation. All of the noise, the variation around that function, will go into the details. So then, in order to get the function back, we throw away the details, because the details were the noise, and we just do our reconstruction using the approximation. We assume the details are zero in the approximation. And we will get back to a function which we hope is a denoised version of our original function. So this is the key. This is why wavelets are such a neat technique for doing denoising. This is the underlying reason. So choosing a wavelet which has a prescribed number of vanishing moments is something that's fairly interesting. Likewise, choosing the support of the wavelet is very important because this determines the length of the filters. So we want to choose filters that are as short as possible typically because that reduces the amount of computation that we have to do. We also like to choose filters which have some regularity properties typically, that they look smoother. Because if the filters look smoother, the output will look smoother, we will introduce less observable or perceivable artifacts. So regularity of our wavelet functions is something we often look for as well. So now we come to Daubechies wavelets. Named after Ingrid Daubechies, who basically invented them. And what she did was she went away and she constructed the wavelet basis which has the minimal support for a given number of vanishing moments. So this is what I mean by designing wavelet bases. She took a particular goal, which is to have a particular number of vanishing moments, but also to have minimum support. That's the shortest filters that you could possibly have for your wavelet basis. How do you do this? Well, I'm not going to go into the whole rigmarole of how you design this, because it gets seriously complicated. But just to give you some insight, firstly, one of the properties that you get with vanishing moments is that you have the first p minus 1 derivatives of the Fourier transform of the wavelet, the mother wavelet, have to be zero at frequency zero. Likewise, the filter also has to have p zeros at z equals 1 in the complex plane. So if it has p zeros at z equals 1, we already know a good deal what that filter is going to look like. The filter has to have p factors of 1 plus z, because that's how we get zeros at minus 1. This will give us a zero at z equals minus 1. And we need to have p zeros there in order to satisfy this vanishing moment condition. So we have to have 1 plus z to the p in our filter, in our transfer function. So that's a starting point. So that's going to be a p-tap filter, or p plus 1-tap filter. We can't quite get away with a filter that short because we also have to satisfy some conditions, this conjugate mirror filter condition. So we have to have a wavelet filter and a scaling filter, and we know that there's this relationship between those two filters that we've looked at in various forms as we go along, and so we can't just take the simplest possible filter here. We have to have some other conditions satisfied. So this is how you design these. As it turns out, when p is equal to 1, the minimum support filter with one vanishing moment is the Haar wavelet basis. With two vanishing moments, you get Dervish's wavelets, which look like this. This is the wavelet function, and this is the scaling function. These are really interesting functions. This is the continuous mother wavelet, remember. And you can see it's not a smooth function at all. So this is what I mean. We sort of satisfied two properties. We've got a vanishing moments, and we've got small support. The support of this thing goes from 0 to 3 here and minus 1 to 2 here. So the support is small, but the function has all these little jagged bits. And in fact, if you zoom in on this little region here, it looks like this thing repeated, actually, I think. This region here looks like this thing repeated. Has kind of a fractal structure. We're going to talk a bit more about fractals later in the course, but this thing has a lot of irregularity. And if you zoom in on a bit of it, you see more and more little spikes and so on. It doesn't smooth down at some particular scale. So it's a very complicated function in some respect. And this is what happens for 3 vanishing moments, 4 vanishing moments. And you can see it gets smoother as we allow more vanishing moments. So it's got more regularity properties. And this is another aspect of allowing this number of vanishing moments to increase. But the filters are consequently going to be longer. So this is the actual filter functions. This is H, this is the low pass, this is the high pass filter. This is the relationship between them. This is a general property of the relationship between them that I haven't actually derived for you, but we could. And this is what the filters look like, and this is the frequency response of the filters, the scaling function and the other function. And you can see, as we make those filters longer, we allow more vanishing moments. The filters themselves get uglier and uglier. I'm not telling what G is in all of these cases, but you can see the transition bands in the frequency domain become a little bit clearer, and you see a little bit more, the behavior there seems more sensible. Okay, so by the time we get here, you can see that they are acting very clearly as a low pass and a high pass filter, and they're mirrors of each other. So the Dervish's wavelets, they're trying to get this minimum support. The Shannon multi-resolution analysis looks for finite support in the frequency domain. So one way of thinking of this, or an example of this, the Shannon one, is you have, in a frequency domain, you have a rectangular support. The support in the frequency domain is a perfect filter. It cuts it into bands perfectly. So it's a rectangle in the frequency domain. In the time domain, it's going to be a sync function. So you see the scaling function looks like a sync function, and the wavelet function looks like a complicated relationship with the sync function. We could derive this, though, from the same sort of integral relationships that I've showed you earlier on. You end up with a wavelet that looks like this, and you notice that it has infinite support. It must have infinite support because it has finite support in the frequency domain, therefore infinite support in the time domain. There are many, many other wavelets out there. There's approximately, 1,000, maybe 100. There's a good number of families of wavelets out there. And typically they occur in families like the Dauber-Schies one, where you have some parameter that you can vary and you get a different set of wavelet bases for each one. But some like the Shannon, they're sort of more fixed. There's a whole list of them there, but that's hardly a complete list. It's, probably one-tenth of the list. Just to give you another example, one of the things that's bad about Dauber-Schies wavelets is the fact that they're not very symmetric, so they don't have linear phase. So what if you loosen the condition on the support, you allow the support to be a little bit bigger, but you look for a wavelet which is more symmetric. So this is again another wavelet basis, and this one is typically called simlets. You hear this ets thing is added on to a word quite often when people are developing some new form of wavelet. So for instance, there are things called framelets, and there are things called ridgelets, and so on, which are all in some ways analogous to this sort of wavelet basis, although they have their own little tweaks and their own little things that are interesting about them. This is the Battle-Lemery one, and you notice here that it's symmetric, but we no longer have sort of finite support of the thing again. So you have to approximate that if you want to do a real transform. And these are based on cubic splines. So cubic splines are a common way of doing approximation of functions. It makes sense that there is a wavelet which corresponds to use of cubic splines when you do your transform. So, on with the second part of lecture 10, which is concerned with wavelet transforms in 2D. So we looked at Fourier transforms in 2D, and we saw that it is very simple to generalize the Fourier transform to two dimensions. Essentially what we did was we took our one-dimensional basis functions, remember the sines and cosines, we took these basis functions and we took one set of basis functions that were horizontal and another set that were vertical, and we multiplied them. So we took one set of basis functions in X and one set of basis functions in Y, and we just took a product of those two sets of bases. This is what we call a separable basis. The nice thing about a separable basis is if you have a function which I write, say, I have a function like this, g of x, f of y, then its Fourier transform will be g of s, f of u. The Fourier transform will separate the same way that the function itself separates. So this is very appealing. The other nice thing about it is it leads to fast algorithms. Remember, the 2D fast Fourier transform, all we effectively did was we did a Fourier transform on the columns and then a Fourier transform on the rows. We didn't have to do a big transform of the whole matrix all at once. We did the rows and then we did the columns. So we could use the same code that we did for our fast Fourier transform in 1D. That was very appealing. Unfortunately, with wavelets, life is not this simple. Doing wavelets in two dimensions is a bit more complicated. This thing here is showing you a wavelet transform of this image. Have I told you where this image comes from? There's an amusing story behind this image. This image, I think, first appeared in the image processing literature in the 70s, back when people were, very compute constrained, and it was a good picture for doing a whole lot of image processing tasks, because it has a bunch of different textures. It has some textures here, has some nice smooth areas, it has some edges, and so on. So it's a good image to test out various algorithms. Because it was used fairly early on, it tended to get used and reused and reused. So this image probably appears in some number of thousands of image processing research papers in the literature. As it turned out, what had happened is the guys, and it was guys in this particular case, the guys who had chosen this particular image to start with, what they'd done is they'd scanned in a picture from Playboy, And then they'd cropped it so that it was appropriately discrete and used that picture. So in the 90s, this was discovered. And the woman who actually appears in this is called Lena. And people contacted her and she said, oh, that's interesting. She was a bit surprised. She didn't do anything about it, but at one point Playboy were actually trying to get people to stop using this image because it's a copyright Playboy image. They own the copyright for it, and people were reproducing this image all over the place. People got a little bit silly about it for a while. But these days, people use this as one of a suite of different images. It's nice to have images that everyone uses in common so you can compare the changes and differences and so on. So this image has been used. This is its wavelet transform over here. And I need to explain to you what this kind of weird pattern is on this picture. So we have this idea of a separable wavelet or a separable basis. And the standard way of constructing a separable basis would be you take the basis functions for the one-dimensional case and you take all of the products of those basis functions. So that's what I'm pointing out up at the top here. I'm going to start with some set of basis functions for the 1D case. These are my psi's up here. And to get the 2D case, I could just take all of the possible products of these. So I'm going to take, this is going to be, say, my X1's, and these are going to be my Y1's. And I take all of the products of all of the possible basis functions in the X direction and all the basis functions in the Y direction. Okay, so that would construct a separable basis for wavelets. The problem with it, the reason we don't do this, is because it mixes the scales. So you see, we have to take the product of all of these possible basis functions, which includes cases where J1 and J2 are different. So we mix the scales up when we do that. So we could have fine scales in the X direction and wide scales in the Y direction. Is that bad? Well, it's not obvious that it's terrible. It would have some weird properties, but one of the things that's nice about wavelets is this separation into scales. If we want to duplicate that separation into scales, we have to have a basis which doesn't mix it. So we need to work out a new way of constructing this two-dimensional wavelet basis. The way we do it is we go back to our approximation, our multi-resolution approximation analysis. And we take spaces, Vj cross Vj, where this is a kind of orthogonal product, to get a space Vj squared. Each of these spaces would be separable. So remember, we would have a basis for Vj, which would be the scaling functions phi at scale j, phi j. So that would be our basis for Vj. So to construct a basis for this thing, we take all of the products of the phi j's with phi j's. So we would take a product that looks something like this, but with the scaling functions, where we have a fixed value of j. And that would form the basis for Vj. And then we perform a multi-resolution approximation in exactly the same way we performed our multi-resolution approximation before, by projecting into successively larger, or smaller and smaller, I should say, approximation spaces. So we project Vj squared into Vj plus 1 squared. And the way we do that is we do the standard projection operation. When we look at the discrete case, when we look at an image where we have discrete data, for instance, that ends up being a filtering operation, as you would expect. It's a filtering operation. We end up having something like this, where having a function that's in some space means that we can write it in terms of the approximations in that space. This is perhaps not the best way of expressing that. Maybe I'll redo this page of my notes next year. The point is that instead of just naively multiplying these basis functions together, we think about what we're trying to achieve. We're trying to achieve this multi-resolution approximation, so at each level of approximation, we find a basis, and then we multiply that basis to get it. And that gives us separable bases for each level of approximation. So that gives us the scaling functions that we need to deal with. We end up with scaling functions that look like this. They're going to be products at a particular scale j. So we end up with phi m1 m2, because we have two dimensions here. We put a square up here. It's not actually a squared function. This is simply to indicate that it's two-dimensional. So m1 and m2 might be our x and y directions. J is the particular octave or the scale. X1 and X2 are positions, if you like. They're the value of that function at various positions in the two-dimensional space. And we form this by a product of the two scaling functions, and the scaling functions themselves are just the standard one-dimensional scaling functions, which we get by a dilation and a translation. And you notice that instead of a 1 on square root 2 to the j, we end up with a 1 on 2 to the j, because we have two factors of 1 on square root 2 to the j. And we perform our approximation in exactly the same way. We take inner products with the basis functions in order to get the coefficients. So notice in this case, this inner product is going to be a two-dimensional integral now. So this inner product is simply a two-dimensional integral of the product of our function that we're transforming or projecting and the basis functions. And then we take these coefficients and we multiply them by the basis functions themselves, and that gives us our approximation. So this exactly mirrors the process of multi-resolution analysis that we went through at the start of lecture 9. Maybe not quite at the start of lecture 9. Again, this integral is going to separate so that if f separates into two functions, f of x1 and f of x2, the product of them, then this integral will separate out into two parts, because this function does, and you'll end up with this nice separation property. So this has the separability property that we want. The trick, the thing that gets confusing here, this is all straightforward, I think. This is a straightforward, by straightforward analogy to the 1D case, we get the two-dimensional case of multi-resolution analysis. The confusing bit comes when we start to think about the wavelet. Remember, in the wavelet case with 1D, we end up with a scaling function and then a wavelet function, and they separate the space into two parts. The wavelet part, which is the WJ, and the VJ, which is the approximation part. And we build this tree of those guys. In this case, 2D case, we end up with three mother wavelets. These have an intuitive explanation, but I'll try and explain the theory for you before we start getting too deep into the intuition. We'll get through the theory part. We have three mother wavelets here. They are very simply constructed. The third one is just the product of the two 1D wavelet functions. But these two are a product of a scaling function and a wavelet function. Scaling function in one direction and a wavelet function in the other direction. And this is the other way around. So we end up with these three wavelet parts. And when we do our decomposition of the space, they filter the spectrum like this. This is showing you a three-dimensional view of the power spectrum of the different filters. So these are the frequencies in the two directions, and this is showing you power vertically. So what sort of filter is this one up here? It's a low pass filter, actually, because this is zero frequency in the middle here. You have to notice that zero goes into here. It's a low pass filter. This is the result of the scaling functions. The two scaling functions together are low passes in both directions. And so you end up with a low pass in both directions. It's a low pass filter. This one over here, what's this one going to be? Band pass. It's a band pass in both directions. You can see we're getting a band here. We're getting a band here, getting a band here, band here. So it's a band pass in both directions. Definitely not a low pass. The low frequencies are getting excluded, the high pass ones are getting excluded as well. If I'd drawn this a bit differently, it would look like a high pass in both directions, but I wanted to make the pictures look clear. So these two are somewhere in between. In one direction they're a low pass filter, so in this direction this guy's a low pass filter, it's passing the low frequencies. But in this direction it's a band pass filter. So this is a product of the wavelet with the scaling function. This is the wavelet function, the wavelet basis, gives us these band passes, and these two are products of the wavelet with the scaling function. So that's these two here, whereas this product of the two wavelet functions gives us the band pass in both directions. In terms of our decomposition, now instead of having this nice binary tree where we go from Vj to Vj plus 1 and Wj plus 1, we go from some approximation Aj, and I haven't written the whole space here, I've just written the coefficients. We have an approximation Aj, that gives us the approximation at the next coarser octave, Aj plus 1, and so on and so forth down there. But instead of dividing into 2 bits, we divide the space into 4 bits. We divide into Aj plus 1, and we divide into 3 different detail spaces, D1, D2, and D3, and you'll be surprised to learn that those 3 detail spaces, each one corresponds to a different mother wavelet. Psi 1, Psi 2, and Psi 3. Okay. In actual calculations, how do we work these out? Well, we do them exactly the same way we did before, either in the continuous case or in the discrete case. This is the discrete case where I've turned all of the wavelet functions into filters, but the same thing holds in either case by direct analogy. Then we want to get the approximation coefficients. We do an inner product of our function with the scaling function. When we want to get the details, we do an inner product of the function with the wavelet function, the wavelet functions. We have 3 different sets of details indexed by k, and they correspond to the 3 different mother wavelet functions you could have. And obviously we get the particular wavelet function by dilations and scalings of the mother wavelet function, exactly the same way we did before. When we look at the actual outcomes of these things in terms of filters, again, we get them by a simple convolution, and you notice that we have downsamplings in both directions now. Also, this convolution is a convolution of the signal with the combination of the two filters. So for the scaling function, we have the two low-pass filters. For D1, we have a low-pass and a high-pass. For D2, we have a high-pass, low-pass. And for D3, we have 2 high-passes. Where again, the notation G-bar means the time-reverse version of that filter. Notice that these products are just the product of the two filters. Okay. This is confusing, I think. To be honest, it took me a long time to really understand what was going on here. So I don't expect you to pick it up in 5 seconds. But what I'm trying to do is introduce the concept to you so that, you know, it has a chance to settle in, you have a chance to think about what's going on here. We have this new basis which is constructed in this particular way. What do the basis functions themselves look like? Well, there are these combinations of the dilations and scalings of these mother wavelets and mother scaling functions, where we constructed the mother wavelets and mother scalings using this rule here. The mother scalings, we just use the product of the scaling functions. The mother wavelets, we construct like this. And we have to do a more complex decomposition because we can't simply break it into 2 spaces now. How do we actually implement it? We still have our pyramidal filter bank construction, but the individual components of it, this is one single block of that pyramid. Okay? because we're taking a function or a signal aj, an approximation at octave j, and we're getting out of it at the other end the approximation and details at octave j plus 1. So if you wanted to build a pyramid out of this, you would have to feed this thing back into the start of this whole big pyramid. The individual blocks, what we do is we do a low pass and a high pass on the rows, we downsample the rows, and then we do the low pass and high pass on the columns of both of these outputs. This is a particularly nice implementation again. It has the same sorts of properties we looked at before, but even better here, we downsample, we do the rows, so that still takes us order n. But then we downsample. So when we do the columns, we only have to do half as many. You notice there are twice as many filters going on here. We have to do, instead of two filters, we do four filters. But we downsampled here, so we do half as many actual computations. So the total number of computations in these columns, or these rows, would be the same. You notice also that the filters H and H, they're all the same filters again. There's no reason why we couldn't use different wavelet bases in different directions, but I don't know of any good reason why you'd want to use different wavelet bases in different directions either. Also, you could reverse the order here. You could do the columns first and then the rows. There's no particular reason for doing the rows first. That's just an implementation detail. You notice here, I do H. If I'm thinking about my doing filters in series, this is going to be H times H. This is two low pass filters in the X and the Y direction, which gives me my AJ. This is HG, which is a low pass and a high pass, which gives me D1. A high pass and a low pass gives me D2, and then two high passes gives me D3. So this is my two-dimensional wavelet transform, and you can see now that it's no harder to implement than the 1D wavelet transform. Wow. It's a little bit harder. You have to keep track of a few more things, but it's not that much harder. In terms of representation, now we would have to record the approximation at some octave big J and all of the details, D1, D2, D3, for all values of J between, whoops, that should be a big J up there, between big J and L, which is our finest or our best approximation, or really our original signal. When we want to do the reconstruction, again, we just reverse the process. We take our approximation at some J plus 1 and our details at that same thing, and we convolve them back with the filters, and we get back to AJ. Incidentally, one pulled me up on this. I take two filters in series, and these are the transfer functions big H. What do I get as the transfer function of the joint, the serial application of filters? Be a product. So a product in the filter domain in the Z domain corresponds to a convolution in the time domain. Why have I written this as a product? That's something for you to think about. Come to me afterwards if you can't work it out. The reconstruction filters just look exactly the same as you would expect. They're just the filters we had before reversed. So no big surprises there. And the other thing is how we store one of these sets of data. Okay, so think about what's happening when I do this. I start with, say an n by n image. So I have n squared values here. When I come out here, this has been downsampled twice, so this is going to have n squared on 4 values in it. Each of these is going to have n squared on 4, so the total number of things here is still n squared. But it would be nice if I had a meaningful way of storing those numbers. They require the same amount of storage as the original image, but it would be nice to have a way of storing them such that they still sort of make some sense. Remember, this is no longer really a one-dimensional signal, it's a two-dimensional image, two-dimensional array. So it would be nice to store these guys as arrays, two-dimensional arrays. So the standard way of doing that is like this. We take, say this was our original image, this big block, this big rectangle around the outside. We would take that and do the transform of the n squared values, and for each of these sets of coefficients, we construct a smaller image. Remember, it's n squared on 4, so the image would be n on 2 by n on 2. So this, all of the aj plus 1 values after downsampling can be stored in this quarter of the original image. And likewise, the details get stored in these bits here. The next thing you do is you say, well, if I were doing a pyramidal deconstruction or a multi-resolution analysis of this, then I would pass this block of data through the same set of filters I used before. And I store it exactly the same way. I store the approximation up in this corner and the details in this. By the way, there's no particular reason why the details have to be in this order and the approximation in the top left. That's just a convention. It's a standard convention that lots of people use in 2D wavelet filtering. So we have our approximation up here. Then I would take this approximation and I would feed that through the same sort of filter banks. And I get a picture like this. So I end up with a picture that looks like this, where I have the details here, lots of values, smaller details here, and so on up to right up here I have the coarsest approximation. And obviously this contains enough information to reconstruct the original image using the reverse process. So that's what this picture is showing you. This is the original image, and this is showing you that construct. So you can see up here, particularly I chose the Haar wavelet basis for this case, so it's not surprising that you see up here a thing that looks like a little copy of this image. You notice that it's not quite right. There's little, it doesn't look quite perfect. There are bits that don't look like the original image because this is an approximation. It has errors when you compare it to the original image. If I expanded that out, it wouldn't look exactly like this picture. But it's an approximation. And these are the detail spaces. So it's a little bit hard with this particular case to see exactly what's going on in these detail spaces. So I have another example here where I've taken a square and I've done a wavelet transform of that square. So what's in this picture? Well, we have a square here. You see in the approximation, you'd be surprised to note we have a square. Big surprise there. What do we see over here? Well, you see very little here. It's a bit easier to see in these pictures. So remember the detail, this one is D3. This corresponds to a high pass in both directions. So what does a high pass do? If you do a high pass in both directions, effectively you're looking for corners. You're looking for things that have transients in both directions. So what's being picked out here? It's the corners. Here it's a bit harder to see, but there are little spikes at each of these four points where the corners of the image are. What's happening here? Well, we have a high pass in this direction and a low pass in this direction. So not surprisingly, the low pass tends to average away anything that's going on in this direction. The high pass emphasizes the edges. It's an edge detection. As you would expect, you get an edge detection in this direction and a low pass in this direction. Over here, we have an edge detection horizontally and a low pass vertically. And you can see the same thing happening at each of these coarser levels of approximation. Because when I did my first approximation, I would end up with a big square here, and then I'd do the high pass on that, and I'd detect edges and detect corners, detect edges. And then I get an approximation here, and so on and so forth as I go up. The other thing that you can see going on here is typically when people do wavelet transforms of images, they don't look at a large number of octaves. So here, I'm looking at 3 octaves. I'm looking at the original image, then 1 approximation, 2 approximations, 3 approximations. So J here would be 3. Not huge. Part of the reason for that is, even though the side of this distance is n, the number of data points is n squared. So the number of calculations is going to be the order of the number of pixels in this image, not the length here. But the number of approximations I can do is going to be log 2 of this length, because each approximation halves the number of data points along the edge. In fact, we take a quarter as we go along in terms of the image sizes. So you can't do as many approximations as you would with a one-dimensional signal. With respect to the number of data points, that is. With respect to the edge, it's still the same, obviously, because it's just a 1D transfer on the rows or the columns. So that's our 2D wavelet transform. And I haven't gone into too many of the details here, but that's the intuition that you need to have about what goes into a 2D wavelet transform. What we're really trying to do is make sure that it's just a generalization of the 1D transform. We're trying to make sure that it has essentially the same characteristics, the same qualities, the same things we have to worry about, basically. Okay, let's get on with the last bit of lecture 10. So what I want to talk about a bit more is applications of wavelets. And this is sort of a very cursory section in some ways, because any of the things that we could have applied Fourier transforms to, we can apply wavelets to. And what I'm going to sort of indicate is some of the places where they have been applied, rather than saying, oh, you could apply them here, you could apply them there. These are some of the places where I've seen people use these sort of things. The most prevalent use, I guess, or the one of the biggest news uses of wavelets was in compression standards. The first place where this appeared, at least that I saw, was in FBI fingerprint, in our database. More recently, the latest standard for JPEG compression uses wavelets rather than cosine transform. Another place would be edge and anomaly detection, and I've used them for this myself, and I've seen them used in the area that I work in, which is network modeling, network analysis, and so on. And one of the places they've been used there is for detecting network anomalies. The idea being, when something anomalous happens in your network, typically it corresponds to a problem such as, for instance, a denial of service attack. So you look at the traffic and you look for anomalies, and when you see something, you go away and you try and stop whatever it was that was bad that was happening. Another example might be an internet worm or a virus. Propagation of them creates anomalies in the traffic stream. So being able to detect them is very useful. And there's at least one research paper on how to do this with network traffic. There are a bunch of other sorts of applications. I'm not going to talk about motion detection this year. Motion detection refers to, for instance, in images, one of the things that would be really nice to be able to do is detect what things are moving in that image. So a classic example of this would be for doing segmentation of images. For instance, you want to be able to track a football in a football game. Another example, in ice hockey, I believe, one of the problems that ice hockey experienced in terms of producing ice hockey games for TV is this little puck is very hard to see when you look at it on a TV. It's this little small hockey puck thing. And so when you play ice hockey on TV, apparently, I've never watched ice hockey on TV, to be honest, but apparently it's very hard to see this puck. So one of the things they've tried doing is making that puck more visible by highlighting it. So how do you do that? Well, if you had a film of ice hockey, you could go away and you could get someone to like look at each image and highlight it. That's not practical in real time. In real time, as you're playing a TV show of a game which is happening at the same time, you have to have automated algorithms. So maybe you have some algorithm which goes and looks for this hockey puck, works out where it is, and tracks it. Do that, you need to do some sort of motion detection. So there are all sorts of reasons for this. One of the other standard reasons is for doing movie compression. So I haven't talked much about movie compression because it's not quite as simple as image compression. There are all sorts of things that go into movie compression. One of them is the sorts of compression techniques we talked about in JPEG. But another thing is doing detection and segmentation of objects. So again, classic example, football game, say an Aussie Rules football game. When you have a film of that, two-thirds of the screen is grass. So it's just green. There's not much happening there. That's great for compression. All for your compression algorithm, all it has to do is say, that was green. That's, I don't have to remember anything else. But the players, unfortunately, move around. So it's not always the same bit of the movie that's going to be green. The players are going to move around, the camera's going to pan. If you can track those players, though, you can say, the bit that I'm tracking, that's not green. That's moving this way, so in the next frame it's going to be over here, and I won't have to worry about that bit being green, and the bit that he was standing in front of, well, maybe that will be green now. So you can keep track of these things, you can do a much better job of compression. So the latest standards for compression do things like motion detection. The reason I'm not going to talk much about motion detection is actually I kind of omitted any real mention of complex wavelets, and the best techniques for doing motion detection use complex wavelets. So it's one of the examples of why you might want to use complex wavelets for a particular application. Another example I will talk about a little bit is denoising. The idea of denoising I've mentioned before, you have some signal and noise has been added to that via some process. For instance, when you made a tape of some audio recording, the magnetic tape is not perfect and so you get tape hiss. And this is noise added on top of your signal. And you want to get rid of that when you listen to it, because you don't want to hear the noise, you want to hear the signal. Okay, let's talk a bit about the FBI example. I'm going to talk about these things in pretty qualitative terms, not the specific algorithm that they use. But let's think about the problem the FBI had. This is actually pretty old hat now. The FBI had a database back in the 80s which had something like 30 million fingerprints in it. Okay, so why do you need 30 million fingerprints? There probably aren't 30 million criminals in the US. Well, you need to have repeats. You have 10 fingers, and you might want fingerprints recorded from all 10 fingers and thumbs from people. You might also then, on top of that, so maybe that's 3 million criminals, you might also fingerprint people for a variety of other reasons. For instance, I believe that people in the US government or the US Army have fingerprints of them taken, partly in the Army so they can work out who you are if you get blown up, I think is part of the reason for that. But generally speaking, there are a lot more people than just criminals in this database. So then you take into account the fact that criminals often repeat offences more than once, and every time that happens they're going to get their fingerprints taken again, partly because people's fingerprints, maybe they change a bit over time, you could get some scars on your finger or something like that, and partly because it just gives them more data to go by when they have some sort of issue happening. So they have this large number of fingerprints, something like 200 million in the past. This is sort of in the 80s. And to that, they added tens of thousands of fingerprints per day. Okay. Today, every time you fly into the US, I'm sure some of you have experienced this already, every time you fly into the US, they fingerprint you. They don't use ink, they have a little scanning device. But you can imagine how many more fingerprints per day they collect this way. They probably collect, I don't know, another million fingerprints a year through this process. Not to mention all of the other Homeland Security efforts that they're doing. This database must be growing astronomically these days. Okay, so you have this very large database. Originally they kept it on cards. They kept ink on cards. You can imagine how awkward this is. Imagine you wanted to search for a criminal through this database if they're on cards. Imagine that you want to transmit this database. Well, what do? You do a fax. You know how bad faxes look. So you have to enlarge the fingerprints and the facts of it, kind of ugly, then you do the comparison. It's really kind of awkward. So with the information technology age, of course, they decided they were going to digitize all of this stuff, convert it all into a digital format. Part of the problem here, though, is fingerprints, they're fairly small, but when you store a fingerprint, you have to store it at a fairly high resolution. Features that you want to use to identify a fingerprint are pretty small little things on that finger. So you need a fairly high resolution scan. Moreover, think about the aliasing issues. You have a look at your finger. Your finger has these little lines. Those little lines represent some sort of frequency component. And so you need to be scanning at least twice the resolution of those little lines. You know, I don't know how many you have. Maybe you have 100 going across your thumb. But that means you're going to have to scan at least twice that level of resolution, at least. And in fact, practically, you probably want to do it several times more finely than that. So the size they settled upon was to have an image, a grayscale image with 256 levels, so this is 8 bits, and 500 pixels per inch resolution. So imagine across, say the length of my thumb, that might be 500 pixels, and across the width, that might be a couple of hundred. So typically, one fingerprint would take something like 700,000 pixels or 6 megabytes of storage. That doesn't sound too bad. Total database would be 200 terabytes. And remember, they started doing this in the early 90s. Today, it's theoretically possible to build a 200 terabyte database. I wouldn't like to do it, but it's theoretically possible. Back then, it wasn't possible. Not even faintly. Building a terabyte database in 93 would have been a nightmare. Getting the data onto it would be a problem. Furthermore, until very recently, one of the scandals in the US after the 9/11 attack was they realized how poor a lot of the IT infrastructure for the FBI and the related organization was. The FBI have a large number of offices around America, as you would expect. A lot of those offices were connected to the central databases by modems, by like a 56K modem. And you guys probably can barely imagine what downloading things at 56K is like. But downloading a significant number of these 6 megabyte files at 56 kilobytes, that would take you a serious amount of time. So you need to compress these files. There is no question about it. You cannot, this was not a practical system without compression. Today it's still not practical, but this is because of the fact that the number of fingerprints going into it is much larger. So you need to be able to take a fingerprint in any airport in America and then transmit that into the central database and do some sort of verification and checking. You need to get fingerprints coming out to FBI offices when they want to check on a particular suspect or you know, various things like this. You need to be able to do compression. So how do you go about doing compression? Well, the basic idea is exactly the same as the sort of idea we talked about with JPEG. So I'm not going to go into any details. The details actually are a bit more complicated, but the principle is the same. The steps are the same. Firstly, do a transform. Take the coefficients from that transform and quantize them, and then do some sort of encoding of that signal. For instance, entropy-based Huffman encoding or arithmetic encoding. The algorithm they came up with, the FBI, they called wavelet scalar quantization. So what they do is they take their wavelet transform, they quantize, and then they do their entropy encoding. There are various tricks when you're doing this. For instance, remember with JPEG, we had different quantization values or a different table for each frequency, because different frequencies had different amounts of importance when you looked at them in the final signal. The same is true of wavelets. You can have different quantization levels for the different scales. So there's a bunch of tricks. And this is why it's a bit more complicated than just transform, quantize, in code. You have to get those things right if you want to get a good algorithm, and that can take a bit of work. So here's an example of a fingerprint that I just nicked off the FBI. This is actually one of the fingerprints from the FBI database. It's publicly available, you can go and get it. And I can't actually tell which one's which. One of them is the real fingerprint, one of them is the encoded fingerprint. And you can see it's done a pretty damn good job. I think probably this right-hand one is the encoded one, because you're starting to see some little artifacts on the edge here. But you can see that it's pretty good. You can also see that the resolution of this image is really needed. There's only a few pixels covering one of these edges, the pattern on your fingerprint. So if you have some sort of scar or, you know, a whorl or whatever it is that they identify, you have to be able to see it. You need resolution like this. Here's a better picture. This is the actual, this is a much finer resolution view so that you can see some of the artifacts. The original size here is nearly 600,000 bytes. Let's see if we can spot some of the JPEG artifacts. Have a look at this scar going across here, and have a look at the scar over here. Particularly the reason for that is because it's sort of linear but goes across these things, you can see the edges of the blocks along here, the 8x8 blocks and the pixels. For instance, up here it's pretty clear on this guy. There's an 8x8 block. And you can see that blockiness coming out. Other sorts of defects, well, there's some things here that are sort of being emphasized in ways that perhaps they weren't in this original image. Or a little scar down here, which is just a little line there. It looks like maybe it goes further across here. Maybe it almost looks like that doesn't join, and maybe that's starting to look like it's not joining there. See? This JPEG compression, this is a good compression ratio for JPEG, 12.9 to 1. You know, you're storing less than 10% of the original data. That's not bad for a JPEG, but you can already start to see the artifacts creeping in to this image. You wouldn't want to have a much bigger compression ratio here, or those artifacts would start to become really, really noticeable. This is the wavelet example. So let me flip backwards and forwards between them a couple of times. JPEG, here's a wavelet, JPEG, wavelet, JPEG, wavelet. Okay. There isn't that much difference. The wavelet compression ratio is 12 to 9. The artifacts, though, are less obvious to me, at least. You know, this line looks much more like the original line. Things like this join here are really much more obvious. This little cut across here, or across here, you can see that they exactly where they are. It looks to me like a better representation of the original image. The real criteria for whether or not this works is when you use these fingerprints for classification, for detecting criminals and so on, do they work better? I have to rely on the fact that the FBI say that they do. The FBI chose this system over something like JPEG. Again, this is the algorithm. We might not quantize the approximation. Maybe we keep the approximation at the same sort of quantization level we have it at. But we quantize each of these details. So we take the detail, and the way of quantizing it is you take this symbol here, which means the floor function. The floor is the largest integer smaller than the number that we're interested in. So I take the absolute value of my number, divide it by my quantization coefficient, take the floor function. The floor function does the quantization for me. And the level of the quantization is determined by this Q. A bigger Q means I get more quantization or fewer bits. Then I multiply it back by Q and the sign of this just to get the actual, my approximation, my quantized version, to be around the same sort of value. Otherwise it's got this divide by Q. So this will be one way of doing quantization. This is a standard way people use all the time, not necessarily exactly this formulation of it, but this same approximation. Sometimes you might use the ceiling function or a rounding operation or something like that. Generally though, you could use a quantization table. You could have a table which mapped particular values here to particular quantized values. And that could be useful if the distribution of these values is non-uniform. If you have a lot more values which are small, for instance, and you care about those small values, maybe you have more quantization levels around those small values. So again, you could think of this almost like a sort of entropy-based encoding step if you use the table. The other thing, Q. This Q might depend on J, the scale. Then, if we want to get back to our original image, we just do an inverse wavelet transform of these details, along with the approximation. Again, I have the same pictures I've shown you before of what quantization actually does. Take some distribution like this, with a bunch of large number of possible values, and quantizes them to a smaller number of possible values. Small number of possible levels. So JPEG 2000 also uses wavelets rather than the discrete cosine transform. JPEG 2000, as I said, one of the issues with wavelets is you have to get a lot of these things right to get a good algorithm, these quantization levels, what wavelet basis you're going to use, so on and so forth. I don't want to spend a huge amount of time trying to tell you all of those details, but you're welcome to go away and look up the JPEG 2000 database. Well, here's a nice little example. So there are other examples of things that you can do with wavelets. So one of the things that people regularly want to do is create music. I don't just mean signal processing people. There are a lot of people out there who like to make music. Various bands make a lot of money out of making music. So there is an interesting problem, which is, how do I create synthetic music? How could I make a computer create music? There are a couple of different components of this. One is, if I have a particular score, a particular piece of music, can I make a computer make sounds like an artist playing that piece of music? And the answer to that is yes, to some approximation, although I think most musicians would argue they can do a better job than a computer. But certainly you can take a musical score, a piece of music, and you can get a computer to generate sounds which sound like instruments, to some approximation. You can get sounds that sound a bit like a piano or a bit like a guitar or whatever. That's sort of interesting, it's useful. But it's not quite a creative process. It could be. I mean, artists put a lot of creative effort into performance. Most of the computer programs that create this sort of performance part of it don't have much creative input that they put into that. But most people, I think, would agree that there's even more creativity that goes into composing music. So another aspect of creating music or creating audio of some form that we would be interested in listening to is to do the composition. Work out what notes should go into the music, what sounds, what instruments should go into that music. This is a highly non-trivial thing to do, and it requires generally people who are extremely clever at music to go away and be very creative. We haven't really got good computer programs, I don't think, that can do this for us yet. But we're on the way there. And one of the things that people have discovered about musical compositions is that they often have these type of fractal structures in them, and I'm going to talk a bit more about fractals in the next lecture, which have scaling type phenomena. You tend to see little cycles in the music which then get repeated at larger and larger intervals. You see structure at different scales in that music. And it's thought by some people at least, that there's this sort of natural mirror between that structure and the way wavelets work. So this guy Wickerhauser went away and he used wavelets to construct a musical score which he then translated into some music for us to listen to. So I'm just going to play that for you here. And you can tell me whether or not you think it's a good piece of music. Okay. So I don't think it's going to win Australian Idol anytime soon. Well, you could argue. It's interesting though. It's not a sterile piece of music. It doesn't have, you know, typically when people have computer generated things, they tend to be very repetitive and very simple. You know, I remember back in the day with earlier computer games where they had this kind of computer generated sound track for the game. And those soundtracks tended to be very simple and very repetitive. And it kind of worked well when you were playing Space Invaders where the game was simple and repetitive, but it's not quite the same thing when you got a when trying to do a musical composition that people are going to actually listen to. This doesn't have that. You listen to this piece of music, it doesn't repeat itself exactly. It has structures that are a little bit repetitive, but they're not exact repetitions of each other. It has structures in it which repeat at different sort of scales, but they're not really the same sort of structure. It's not really like the music that we're sort of conventionally used to listening to. So I don't think it's going to sort of win the popularity stakes. Certainly has some interest to it, I feel. People have done all sorts of things in this sort of area. You know, people have analyzed whale sounds and tried to make sounds that sound like whale sounds using wavelets and so on. It's kind of fun. So there's a whole lot of things in this sort of area people have done. A lot of it you might think is playing around, but what this is really getting at is some really fundamental things about something we spend a lot of our time listening to. It's really, you know, seems like at one level a trivial bit of messing around, but at another level it's really basic science about, you know, our psychology. Okay, back to something a little bit more practical, denoising. Okay, as I said, a lot of the time you have a signal, that signal has noise on top of it, you would like to get rid of the noise. The Dolby solution, the double-ended solution, is not usually practical. You don't usually get to do something special when you do the encoding that will let you remove the noise afterwards. So you have to have some technique which will allow you to get rid of that noise. We talked a little bit about this in the last lecture when we talked about vanishing moments. Remember, one of the sort of implicit assumptions that you can make when you're denoising, it's not always the case, but you could assume that you have this nice smooth function which locally you can represent as a polynomial. So the polynomial pits you pass through by having enough vanishing moments in your wavelet basis, and the thing that's left is the noise. So the details you then zero and you do the reverse transform with zero details and you get back an approximation for your smooth function. Okay, so there's some interesting things that go on here. Remember with Derbyshire's wavelets, we had the minimal support wavelet for a given number of vanishing moments. The number of vanishing moments depends on the polynomial degree. So imagine you want to fit, you want to say that my curve is locally, it looks like a straight line. Okay, locally you could have a straight line here, but the curve sort of looks like this. So if you want to have an approximation to it that fits over this range, maybe you need a quadratic. So you have a quadratic over this range, but then you have a wider range for those points. The corresponding wavelet theta, because it will have more vanishing moments, will have a wider range. So it doesn't necessarily get you anything to just make the number of vanishing moments really large. I mean, in theory, you could make the number of vanishing moments 10,000. But then you have a filter of length 10,000, So that approximation to a polynomial of order 10,000 would have to work over the whole length of that filter, or a bit further. In some cases that might work, but higher order polynomial approximations have a lot of problems with oscillations. So typically, this doesn't buy you anything for p more than, say, 5 or 6 or 7 or something, that sort of order of magnitude. What I'm going to show you is an example with the Ha wavelet basis. And I'm going to do a couple of things. So this is our dyadic grid, the way we've looked at it so far, with frequency going up the page. But there's no reason for up to be necessarily the way we go with frequency. What we quite often do is plot scale along the y-axis, or the octave along the y-axis, and then the dyadic grid looks like this. These red points would be my original samples, so this point here would be the 49th sample along here, down sample along here, this would be D125, that's the 25th detail at scale octave 1, this is the 13th detail at octave 2, and you can see we're halving as we go up here, because we have half as many data points. Up until this point, where we don't just store the details at octave 5, we also store the approximation at this point. So this is my dyadic grid. This is a test signal that was used by a guy called David Donahoe in one of the earlier papers on wavelet denoising, possibly the first one, but he used this signal called blocks. You can see that it's a piecewise constant signal. We have to get past this idea of local regularity, because clearly at these edges here, you know, any of these edges, we can't approximate our signal by any sort of polynomial at all. So this is a little bit harder than the problem I originally posed to you, where you have this smooth signal that you're going to try and approximate with wavelets. This is a bit harder because we have these square edges. This will also be hard for doing it in the Fourier domain, because in the Fourier domain, remember, these edges, they end up having transients over the whole frequency band. One of these, if we took one of these bits as a pulse, we'd see the sync function, which has power through the whole frequency band. So if we took a low-pass filter, we add some noise to this thing, and then we take a low-pass filter of that, what it will tend to do is it will get rid of the noise in these nice flat parts, but it will smooth these edges out. It will tend to, you know, make those edges look smoother as well. That's what it's going to do. Remember, a low-pass filter, a moving average or something like that, it's a smoother, it tends to smooth the data. So that's not going to work terribly well. That would work if we had a smooth function that we were interested in the first place. But we don't have a smooth function we're interested in the first place. We have a function which is sort of exactly not smooth. It has these big transitions in it, and we'd like to work out how these transitions work. So let's have a look at the wavelet transform. So the reason I showed you this dyadic grid back here is so that you may understand what's being shown in this picture. Along here, along this lowest axis, along the zeroth axis would be the original data, but I haven't shown that. Along this axis is approximation 1, detail 1, detail 2, detail 3, detail 4, detail 5, detail 6, detail 7, and detail 8 at the different scales. And you notice that well, firstly, there's fewer points up here because it's a dyadic grid. We're downsampling as we go up through the scales. Secondly, you notice that there's an awful lot of small values here, but then there are some spikes. Why should that be? Well, let's think about what the wavelet transform would do here. Where the function is smooth, so this is a Haar transform here, so where, for instance, it's constant, where it was constant in this picture, the Haar transform would give details that are zero. The approximation would tell you the value, and the details would be zero. Where you have a transition, the higher wavelet transform will record that edge. So if we just took a wavelet transform of this, we would get a picture like this, but all of these little guys would go away. That'd be zero, and these big guys would record the edges. They would just tell us where those edges were. So in some sense, there's two different signals in here. One is the noise, one is the data. The noise appears as this sort of noisy terms, and the data appears as these big spikes. It's a bit more obvious where the noise and the data is than in this original picture. Secondly, sort of think of this as a local regularity. This is locally piecewise constant. So here, worrying about the details works. We would set the details to zero, and that would mean that we get our piecewise, in this case, constant, because the higher wavelet has only this first vanishing moment, one vanishing moment. So it only passes polynomials of degree zero, which are constant. So the higher wavelet transform can pick up horizontal lines. So it does that quite well. So if we set the details to zero, then we will pick up this straight line. But what happens with this edge? We don't want to set that part of the transform to zero. So what we do instead, let's have a look at a histogram, for instance. This is a histogram of these values. And you see in the histogram that there are a whole lot of these values that are pretty small, and then there are a couple of values that are big. So what we can do is say, well, there's a clear division here. Let's keep these big values and get rid of these small values. So that's what you basically do. There's a couple of different ways of doing that. There's things called soft thresholding and hard thresholding. So the idea of hard thresholding would be I put a threshold, say, at 5. And anything below 5 or above minus 5, I set that to 0. I get rid of it. That would be getting rid of those details. Okay, so that would get rid of all of that stuff. Actually, what a lot of people do is called soft thresholding. So the idea of soft thresholding is you just move everything in towards zero, and you end up with a histogram like this. You subtract some value from all of your coefficients, or the absolute value of all of your coefficients. So you see, this guy got moved into here as well. Why is soft thresholding a better idea than hard thresholding? To be honest, I don't have a good intuitive answer for that. It seems to work a bit better, is the answer that I know. I'm sure if you talk to David Donohoe, he will give you a much better theoretical answer for why this is the case. So this is the threshold of transform. I got rid of all of those bits of noise that were below the threshold, and I shrank these other coefficients down a little bit. Let's invert the transform now, and I get the blue curve. The red curve shows what it should be. The blue curve is the reconstructed signal. And you can see it does a pretty good job given the amount of noise I put into this signal. You can see there are little kind of extra edges in a few places. There are a few chunks here and there that are just not quite right. But generally speaking, it's an extremely good reconstruction of the original signal. It still has these sort of little chunky artifacts and edges and things like that. So one thing that we might want to do is use a wavelet which has a little bit more regularity, a bit more smoothness, in order to try and make this picture look a little bit smoother. This is what you get if you use simlets of order 8, so with 8 vanishing moments. Is that better or not? I can't really say whether it's better. You see these little oscillations, these look a bit like Gibbs phenomena everywhere. In some ways, they look a little bit worse to me. They might be a little bit better. It depends on your application. Depends on why you're trying to remove this noise and what effect that particular sort of artifact would have in comparison to these sorts of artifacts. So that's our reconstructed signal. So this is the soft thresholding equation. We would take coefficients that... Oh God, this thing really not working very well. We would take coefficients that we took some value off of it. So this is for positive details. If I had negative values, I'd have to add on some values. I want to shift them in towards zero. And then you do the inverse wavelet transform. So simple algorithm. Again, very simple algorithm, easy to implement. Another application. So in this application, I'm going to do edge detection. Why am I going to do edge detection? Well, in a lot of interesting examples, what we want to be able to do is find edges in images or edges in signals. Edges in a signal might correspond to some sort of anomaly which we want to detect. And so we want to be able to pick these out of the signal. So this is a test signal, and what I'm going to look at for my edge detection is the cumulative sum of that signal plus some noise. So I've deliberately added in noise again to make my life a bit harder here, and the cumulative sum, I just add up the values as I go along. And you can see that wherever I had a big spike in the original signal, I get an edge in this signal. Why am I looking at this particular case? Well, one way of doing edge detection is to run a differencing filter on it, a high-pass filter. If I run a naive high-pass filter or differencer on the signal, I get this. I get garbage. Because I included noise in my original signal, this is not actually a smooth line. This is a line with lots of variations in it. So this simple high-pass filter is not adequate. I would have to run some sort of clever bandpass filter in order to extract the noise and still find those edges. Because the edges still have this high frequency component, but the noise also is in that high frequency component. So I'd need some clever bandpass filter that's tuned to the application if that's what I wanted to be able to do. This is the sort of picture I get with a wavelet filter. And you can see that it's not a perfect replica of this thing, but it's damn good. We picked out those edges reasonably well and how big those edges actually were. The algorithm that I used is exactly the same as the algorithm I used for denoising. What I'm going to do is take my signal, do a wavelet transform, get rid of the details that have small values, and then do an inverse transform. But in this particular case, I'm going to leave out the approximation, because the approximation tells me that the shape of this thing, the details are the bit that tell me about the sort of deviations away from that broad shape, which is what I want to really pick up. So that's how I can do edge detection. So now you've had an introduction to wavelets. Most of the examples that I presented were worked through using Wavelab, which is a free MATLAB toolkit for doing wavelets. So if you need to be able to do wavelets, you can download this thing and you can do it. And they have a lot of routines for doing all of the basic sort of wavelet transforms, generating these wavelet filters and so on and so forth. So I think